And we've got the Forbidden Archaeologist with us, Michael Cremo, tonight, and we'll be back with him and your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We are back with Michael Cremo, your phone calls as well this hour as we talk about the ancients. So the Neanderthals, did they evolve from apes? How did they get here, Michael?
Well, that's a very good question. I think before we even ask the question where the Neanderthals came from or where we came from or when and where any living thing came from, we should first of all ask, what are we? What is a Neanderthal? What is a human being? What is an ape or a monkey? And for me, it's a very simple concept that these are all vehicles for conscious selves. That's what mm-hmm. an ape body is, or a human body, or a plant body, or a Neanderthal body is. It's a vehicle for a conscious self to exist on this level of reality, which is dominated by matter. Originally, all the conscious selves come from some higher level of reality where the ruling principle is loving harmony and cooperation among all conscious beings and the source of all conscious beings. But if a conscious self becomes egotistical or selfish, it can no longer exist on that level of reality. There has to be an alternative reality for it to act out its desires to control and dominate and exploit matter and other living things. So all of these different vehicles made of matter are provided by a higher intelligence in the cosmos, I believe. So whether it's the Neanderthal body or the anatomically modern human body or a plant body, an animal body, a fish body, a bird body, a dinosaur body, a Sasquatch body, whatever kind of body it is, it's a vehicle that's been provided for a conscious self to function on this level of reality. So there are a variety of vehicles because each conscious self has different desires, different ambitions it needs to fulfill. So therefore, these different kinds of vehicles, Neanderthal, Australopithecus, ape, monkey, fish, insect, bird, human, the full range of possibilities is there. And we, by our mental activities and our cultivation of certain desires, get a certain type of vehicle. I may have been in a Neanderthal vehicle in some past life. That's the kind of evolution I believe in, the evolution of the conscious self through different kinds of forms of bodily vehicles, eventually attaining the human vehicle in which it's possible to transcend this whole level of reality and restore consciousness to its original pure state.
You know, and I think you're absolutely right, Michael, that's probably the rationale, and it is difficult for a lot of mainstream scientists to come up with that theory, because I don't think they really understand the complexity of life. I really don't.
No, they don't. They don't. And the one thing that they really fail to understand is that the conscious self has a separate existence from matter. From, you know, they think matter produces consciousness. Chemicals in the brain produce consciousness, but only temporarily. And at the time of death, when the chemicals in the brain become disorganized, there's no more consciousness. There's nothing. That's it. So I think that's the fundamental mistake that they make. They don't understand the difference between the conscious self and the bodily vehicle made of matter that covers it at the present moment. That's their most fundamental mistake. And on the basis of that mistake, you know, we've got a very materialistic civilization that's based on the domination, control, and exploitation of matter by competing groups, and therefore there's so much conflict on all levels of human society, conflict among nations, conflict among races, conflict among genders, conflict among religions. If we understood our really true nature as conscious selves, each one of us, we'd see our true equality and wouldn't allow ourselves to be divided on the basis of superficial external characteristics like race, nationality, gender, and so on.
To the phones now we go. Let's go on our wild card line to Oregon. Alyssa is with us. Hi there, Alyssa.
Hi, George. Love the show.
Thank you. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here. I've got a question for your guest.
Okay.
Do you think it's possible that ancients like Quetzalcoatl are actually evolved humans from the future who've learned to manipulate time?
That is one possibility. You know, in my book, Forbidden Archaeology, you know, I presented archaeological evidence showing that humans like us existed in the distant past. So I didn't offer any explanation for why that is, that evidence is there, because I wanted people to be free to think about it for themselves and come up with their own explanation. And one explanation that has been offered is the one that you're suggesting, in other words, time travelers. Others have offered an explanation involving extraterrestrial beings, and still others have just offered some new theory of evolution where humans like us evolved far earlier than the past. My own explanation involves a lot of those things all kind of put together in one. But your idea is one of the possibilities.
And of course, is it conceivable, Michael, that as we talk about the evolution of humankind, last week I had a guest on who talked about where we're going to be in the future, and we're going to change. And he thinks a lot of it has to do with artificial intelligence. But what do you think the next metamorphosis of a human might be?
Well, you know, I look at this through the lens of the Vedic teachings of India, which accept the idea that the conscious self is different than the bodily vehicle made of matter, and that at the time of death, the state of one's consciousness determines what one's next bodily vehicle is going to be like. So there are different types of bodily vehicles that are available. It could be another human vehicle on this planet. It could be a more subtle type of bodily vehicle on some higher dimension of reality, or it could be a body that is made of the element of pure consciousness, which is beyond time, beyond this whole time factor that we're under the influence of, that's divided into past, present, and future, so that we're wondering what happened in the past, what's going on now, what's going to happen in the future. It's possible that the next evolution of consciousness will be to completely transcend all of that and be situated on the platform of timelessness. So that is how I'm trying to evolve my consciousness to achieve that level.
West of the Rockies, Roger's with us in Arizona. Hello, Raj, go ahead.
Yes, I want to connect some dots here.
All right.
They found some isotopes on Mars that show that there was a hydrogen bomb that blew up there about, they say, several millions ago. What happened 5,000 years ago if a culture came into this solar system, wanted to destroy both planets, they bombed both places at the same time?
Can't rule that out, Michael.
Can't. You know, of course, we see movies like Star Wars and things like that about interplanetary wars or intergalactic wars and conflicts and struggles that have gone on. You know, that is something that isn't, you know, just the product of some imagination by filmmakers. According to the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, there are 400,000 human-like species scattered throughout the various planetary systems that make up the cosmos. And beyond that, they say we're in a multi-level cosmos, multi-dimensional cosmos. So you have beings inhabiting all of these different areas and planetary systems, and there have been conflicts among them involving weapons, some of them which resemble in many ways modern nuclear weapons. So I wouldn't rule out at all the possibility that what the caller says is a fact.
Next up, we've got Joe in Long Island, New York. Hey, Joe.
Hi, Michael. I have two questions. First would be, would humans and or the Neanderthal ever have been really adequately equipped to deal with the animal kingdom? I mean, even now, if you put the average person out into the wilds, it would be hard to cope with, say, the middle of Africa with the wildlife. So I think for our tech be overrun in certain cases and segments of the animal kingdom.
You're breaking up here, Joe. So we'll just go with that. Can you figure out that question, Michael?
Yeah. Well, of course, even today, there are people who live in wilderness areas of the world that are inhabited by lots of animals. I mean, I remember growing up in Florida as a young boy, we had to be aware of the animals. There were alligators in the local canals and lakes. There were cottonmouth rattlesnakes, you know, that would be all over the place. There are lots of animals around, even some very dangerous ones, but we managed to survive somehow. And as I said, there are people who even today in various parts of the world live in very close contact with all kinds of wild animals, some very dangerous ones, and have managed to survive. So if we're doing it today, I think we could have done so in the past.
Michael, what are your next projects? What are you doing next?
Well, one thing I'm working on is a follow-up book to Forbidden Archaeology, so I'm working on that. In April, I'm going to be going to South Africa to speak at an event that's being organized by Michael Tellinger. He calls it Ubuntu, an Ubuntu conference. So I'm going to be speaking there in April of 2018. I'm always working on something, so if people would like to know about my upcoming events, they could look at my website, mcremo.com, mcremo.com, and find out what my upcoming lectures and interviews and things like that are going to be.
All right, super. Let's go to Gene now, first-time caller in Indio, California. Hi, Gene, go ahead.
If we could time travel back to Eden Lemuria, our original continent before we sank, and warn the government to quit what they were doing, or they'll sink, we could be back there where we were equal with animals and gender, lived forever, had an ideal climate, and the sun plant evolution was a government, because right now they're pushing us into an ice age, blocking the sun. So we've done full circle back to sun worship, and the slow, you know, weather that we're having, they're blocking the sun with chemtrails, deflecting the sun's rays. The economy needs a war, and now the sun is the new terrorist. And they're warring that, which is criminally insane, because the sun is the source of life. So that would be a solution. We don't have to time travel, literally. We could connect with the government there that did things to the earth to sink us, as they're doing now, you know, the Babylon or whoever. You know, warn them that we're coming from the future. We're still sinking. We've lost a lot of islands. You know, Florida is sinking, and they're blocking the sun, which would reduce the rising ocean vortex, and doing everything just to run an economy which has to produce enemies, be it killer bees, Iraq, sound to jerk.
All right. Well, you were all over the map there, Gene, to be sure.
Well, I think what she's doing is she's listing a lot of features of the current time cycle that we're in. Yeah, the ancients realized there were larger cycles of time. I mean, we're used to the day and night cycle, the seasonal cycle, you know, summer, fall, winter, spring. But
I think those feels like those are gone now.
Yeah. Of course, you were talking a little bit earlier in the show about the very cold weather.
Oh, my God. It's unbelievable, Michael.
It's definitely a different experience than people are going to go through in July in the Northern Hemisphere,
yeah.
Anyway.
What global warming when you have this kind of weather?
Yeah. So, but in these larger cycles of time, which are called yugas, they're different conditions. There's a Satya Yuga, a golden age where people live for vast periods of time. They live in peace and harmony, close to nature. It's followed by another cycle called the Treta Yuga, and then another called the Dwapara Yuga, and things get progressively worse until we enter the cycle that we're in now, which
Hold on, Michael. Let's talk about the rest of the questions when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And we are back with Michael Cremo. Michael, the concept of forbidden archaeology, are other archaeologists jumping on board, basically?
Many of them are jumping on board to attack it.
Yeah, that's what
that's
I thought.
Totally true.
But not to support you, huh?
You know, some actually do. You know, there are a few who have recognized some positive contributions that the book has made to the discipline of archaeology. There are some like that. You know, they may not agree with me on every single point, but, you know, there are historians and archaeologists who have had some positive things to say about my book, Forbidden Archaeology. For example, there's a historian, David Oldroyd, a historian of archaeology. He and his co-author wrote a 21-page article about forbidden archaeology in an academic journal. And they said, does this book make any contribution to the discipline of paleoanthropology? That's the science of human origins and antiquity. And they said, yes, for two reasons. First of all, they said, nobody has gone into the history of archaeology in such depth before. So they thought that was one positive contribution that the book made. And second, they said the book raises important questions about the nature of scientific truth claims. You know, scientists attach various levels of certainty to their ideas, and they attach a level of almost absolute certainty to their current theories about human origins and antiquity. But David Oldroyd and his co-authors said in their review of Forbidden Archaeology that my co-author Richard Thompson and I had done a good job in problematizing that high level of certainty that scientists give to their current ideas about human origins and antiquity. So you do find some like that. And then there was another scientist, actually in this case a geologist, who once invited me to speak at the University of Oklahoma in Norman to the geology graduate students and professors there. And I told him about a case I had been investigating in Oklahoma where, at a place called the Holloman Quarry, some human artifacts had been found in layers of rock almost 2 million years old. And he became interested in that case himself and started investigating it. So yeah, there are a few. I get letters from students of archaeology that, I mean, one student wrote to me and said he was out on a dig with his professor, and he just happened to mention to his professor, maybe humans have been around a lot longer than we think possible. And he said his professor said, I've got a book you should read. And his professor gave him a copy of Forbidden Archaeology.
Beautiful.
Yeah, so sometimes there are,
it does work.
A few positive signs out there.
Back to the phones. West of the Rockies, Archer is in Maui in Hawaii. Hey, Arch, go ahead.
Hey, aloha, and Michael, and George.
Aloha.
You too, Archer.
Welcome me to come aboard.
You are.
Michael, in 1997, I heard you telling Art Bell about the metallic vase, Dorchester, Massachusetts, pre-Cambrian, at least 600 million years old. In the next few days, I was calling and recording conversations with colleagues, mostly in Europe and Scandinavia, and we just decided to, address the question, is it human or ET manufacture? We described it to a T, completely and in every detail, absolutely correct. And so subsequent to that, I tried to put you in touch with Bo Olsen, my Norwegian colleague. You almost met in person some years ago when you were lecturing in Scandinavia. And I just
We actually did meet. I think I was in Helsinki, Finland, for a meeting of the European Association of Archaeologists, and I'm not remembering correctly, but I think I did meet him.
Yes, I thought you did. And in any case, the Genome Project is one of the groups of scientists that have been affirming quite a bit what we were telling you at that time. I did send you a DVD, a CD, actually, and had very wonderful conversations with your secretary then. And I just wanted you to know that we're pursuing it. We're digging. The digging is going very well, and it was very nice subsequent to that that the Genome Project confirmed a gradient that we had already been discussing for at least 15 years, which affirms that the Out of Africa story is not correct and it couldn't have happened. And I just wanted to thank you, because we're definitely pursuing it.
Well, thank you. That's one thing I wanted to do with my work, is inspire new generations of researchers to take up these topics. So it's very inspiring to hear that.
Next up, we go to Kevan in Hilo, Hawaii. Lots of Hawaiian calls tonight. Go ahead, Kevan.
Good evening. Happy New Year to you, gentlemen.
You too, sir.
Happy New Year.
Yes, my question was, what do you think about the possibility that perhaps human beings originated on Mars, let's say, and recolonized Earth, and then a war broke out later between the colonies and the home world, and that's why there are craters on one side of Mars, and the majority of those that have been detected after, you know, erosion and all that on Earth are largely on one side of Earth. And what are you, would be your take on that?
Well, a lot of my ideas are inspired by my studies in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, which tell us that there are 400,000 human-like species scattered throughout the cosmos, and that all the planets and celestial bodies are inhabited in one way or another. So they also tell us that there have been struggles and conflicts between the beings existing on different planets and different levels of reality. The basic conflict being one, you might say, between light and darkness. Those who are interested more in consciousness and spirit, and those who are more interested in dominating, controlling, and exploiting matter for selfish purposes. So there have been migrations from planet to planet and conflicts going on between these different forces, and these are recorded in these different ancient wisdom traditions. So the kind of thing that you're talking about, in principle, I don't have any objection to.
Michael, let's get back to that Oppenheimer statement again about what could have been an atomic war here. And again, is it possible, conceivable, that if there was one, it was started by extraterrestrials?
That's a possibility. You know, the Mahabharata, one of the classic texts of ancient India, describes a war that took place on this planet thousands of years ago. And it was stated that in preparation for this war, beings of a demoniac nature from other parts of the universe deliberately took birth in the process of reincarnation on this planet in order to further their ends and also to block them, higher beings on the side of the forces of goodness also took birth on this planet in order to engage in this conflict that is described as having taken place about 5,000 years ago at a place called Kurukshetra in northern India. So there was an interplanetary aspect to it.
Could they have been witnesses to some major event? How do you think they got that story?
I think the story is there because it's an actual history. It's something that happened. And that's why it's recorded in these ancient texts. And, you know, Indian art and drama and music and culture reflect that.
Next up, we go to John in Michigan. Welcome to the program. First-time caller for John. Hi, John.
Hi.
Good to have you with us. Go ahead, John.
Well, yeah, I got a couple of things here. I was wondering, you know, kind of all over pretty much on various continents and stuff, now they're starting to dig up these pyramids, like in Europe and stuff like that. And then you got like Greek mythology and the Holy Bible. I'm pretty religious, actually, believe it or not. But I'm just kind of wondering if it's possible that maybe the Bible isn't more like a history book of some, you know, things that happened in the past from those that remembered that were able to write it down in the best way that they could.
That's very conceivable, Michael, that the Bible is truly a road guide to the past.
I tend to think that myself. And as I look at, you know, these different ancient wisdom traditions and cultures scattered around the world, they all seem to have some common features. And, you know, the caller was mentioning some common features of architecture, too. And I think the reason is that in ancient times, there was kind of a worldwide advanced human civilization that spread its influence all over this planet. And these different cultural centers were in contact with each other. And I think that's why the similarities are there. You know, it's as if they were all looking, say, like at a mountain, you could say, and somebody's looking at it from the east, and somebody's looking at it from the west, and somebody's looking at it from the north and the south. And their descriptions, although they'll be slightly different because they're looking at it from a different angle of vision, there's still going to be a lot of similarities because basically they're looking at the same thing, the same mountain. So that's how I would explain a lot of the similarities that we see between the accounts of cosmology and history that we see in a lot of these different wisdom traditions, like the Bible and the Greek cosmology and ancient Indian cosmology. I think there's similarities there because they're all looking at the same thing from their different points of view.
Let's go out to New Jersey. Opal's with us. Welcome to the program, East of the Rockies. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi there.
This has been a wonderful, wonderful interview. Thank you very much.
And you're very welcome.
Paul, truly. My question is, have you ever collaborated collaborated with Shirley MacLaine and the work that she has provided? And before you even answer that, I would like to emphasize to you that your explanation and what you were talking about is in itself out on a limb, but you're so peaceful and so certain and confident of what you're saying. It's really, it's profound, and I appreciate that very much.
We had Shirley MacLaine, Opal, on the program several months ago. She's been on before as well, and she's a pretty compelling person on the air. But go ahead, Michael.
Well, I haven't met Shirley MacLaine. I'd like to, but, you know, I understand she's a supporter of the idea of reincarnation and some of the other
and
ideas.
And extraterrestrials and everything else, yeah.
Talking about, so I think she was quite courageous in starting to speak about those things some years ago when it wasn't so common for people in her industry to do that. So I think she has made a nice contribution.
Michael, as we wrap things up, are we ever going to get really these answers to the question, how old are we as humans?
I think we are gradually getting the answers. I think step by step, some scientists are making a little bit of progress in the right direction, but I think they've got a long way to go. But if you want to see the roadmap of where they're going, have a look at Forbidden Archaeology.
You got it. Michael Cremo, our special guest. Up next, we're going live to the United Kingdom to talk about gravity. What does it all mean? It's much more than science. Next.